Hey everybody, Nick DeOlias here, and this is episode 86 of the Farm Middle Podcast. We are in the midst of January, and that happens to be National Mentoring Month. I thought I would mention that in reference to all the efforts that the team is working on at the CNX Foundation's Mentorship Academy. Thanks for all that you do, team. And if you want to get involved in the Mentorship Academy, check out the CNX Foundation website. We're also all across social media, and feel free to connect with the foundation to get moving on becoming a partner host entity or a mentor, or if you know of a high school junior or senior in a urban or rural school district in Western PA who doesn't want to go to college right out of the chute, but does want to start on a profession or a career journey. Be happy to talk to you. In this episode 86, it's first going to air on January 11th. And that happens to be the birthday of one of my idols and one of the most important Americans in our nation's history. I'll get to a mini dedication to this great mind and leader at the end of our episode, so stay tuned, sit tight for that. But let's kick things off now with talking about what episode 86 is going to be dedicated to in the world of sports. The year 1986, it saw a series of record-setting performances which constitute the dedication for our current Far Middle episode. So first, in the 1985-1986 NHL season, there was a phenom by the name of Wayne Gretzky who set the NHL record for most points in a single season at 215. Those points consisted of 52 goals, 163 assists, and it was his third consecutive season logging in at least 200 points. Amazing. Now, you constant listeners know that as a self-respecting Pittsburgher, I am a Mario Lemieux fan first, but there's no denying the greatness of Gretzky, and that 85-86 season was in many ways, 215 of them to be exact, his masterpiece season. Second, you jump over to the world of golf. Jack Nicklaus in 86 became the oldest player to win the Masters. So he did that in 86 at age 46. And not only did he set the record with age for the Masters, but that was also his 18th record major title and also his final major. Then you jump over to baseball. In 1986, there was a pitcher. He pitched for the Boston Red Sox. His name was Roger Clemens, and he set the major league record for strikeouts in a single game when he fanned 20 Seattle Mariners in late April. Clemens that year went on to win the Cy Young. Fourth, in 1986, the Boston Celtics in the NBA, they cap the 85-86 season with an NBA title, yet another title, and the Celtics set a record for wins in a season at 82 games, which included, by the way, playoff wins. At home that season, the 85-86 season, they were an amazing 47 wins and one loss, and one of the greatest seasons, I think, in NBA history. Fifth and finally, in terms of record-breaking events in 1986, there was a boxer, a young boxer by the name of Mike Tyson, who became the youngest heavyweight champion in the history of boxing, and he earned his title by knockout, not surprisingly. But who was his opponent that he knocked out? Do any of you remember? His name was Trevor Burbick. Yep, 1986 was a year that brought us a group of five amazing record-setting performances. They spanned the world of sports. Thus, our dedication for episode 86 goes to the Fab Five record-setters of 1986. All right, now that's a motivational start for an episode. Let's use that motivation to start making connections and connecting dots. And we do that, of course, to honor James Burke of the great BBC series Connections. We do that with every episode of The Far Middle. So in 1986, we just discussed all kinds of records being set, as in positive records, in the world of sports. But unfortunately, in 2023, we're seeing all kinds of record-breaking situations and conditions being set, but this time of the negative variety, and in the worlds of business and with respect to society and with quality of life. And an illustration of this negative phenomenon can be found in the UK, which has been battered by energy insecurity and raging inflation and recession, and particularly the industry of brewing, which of course is one of the most historical and traditional industries you're going to find in the UK. It's under economic siege from these factors that I just mentioned, to the point where the industry of brewing is facing a literal economic extinction. Just consider the substantial and numerous headwinds that the brewing industry is facing in the UK today. So first, of course, to be successful in brewing, you're going to need people to drink your product. And the consumer in the UK, They're going about their spending habits with a consumer confidence level that is at best zero, and maybe, if this is possible, might actually be negative. So sales are down for beer, way down. Second thing that they're contending with as a headwind if you're a brewer in the UK, you got general inflation that is raging across the entire nation, and that's creating pressure on real wage rates of workers, which inevitably is going to lead to labor shortages and labor strife and strikes. In the brewing industry, especially key links in the production chain of brewing beer, it's in the middle of a lot of that labor strife, which is going to hit costs and supply chain. Third headwind is tied to general inflation and really the key root cause to it, which is energy inflation. So this was created and brought to you or brought to the UK by the ill-advised energy and climate policies of its leadership. And record high energy bills in the UK are not just eroding disposable income of consumers who should be buying beer, but also it's raising the cost of producing beer because brewing utilizes energy as a key input for production. Most breweries in the UK, they're facing electricity costs that have tripled from what they were a short time ago, as in up 300%. Think about that. And then the fourth headwind, it's not just energy or electricity bills that are up, everything is up in cost. And why is that? Well, because energy is the input of just about every product in the supply chain or in a production line that one can imagine. So for brewing, another key ingredient in the process is CO2. Ironically, which is used to purge production lines when brewing beer. Well, CO2, besides being plant food, it's also an industrial gas that must, like everything else, be manufactured. And manufacturing necessarily requires energy, so if energy costs are skyrocketing, then you can be sure their products from manufacturing, like industrial CO2, they're also going to be skyrocketing in costs. And indeed, CO2 is up almost 400%, over a short period of time, a quadrupling. So two key input components in the process of brewing beer, electricity and industrial CO2, they're up 300% and 400% respectively in a very short period of time. You don't need to be a business genius. You don't have to have a PhD in economics to quickly deduce that when they are coupled together with collapsing consumer confidence, it's going to spell serious trouble for the industry of brewing. Now, where do we trace all these headwinds that are afflicting the industry of brewing in the UK to? Well, that's an easy question to answer. Clearly, the root causes of all these ailments are energy and climate policies that the UK ran headfirst toward and eagerly embraced. The policies under cover of the public interest in tackling climate change, they manufactured exactly what they were designed to create, which was energy scarcity. And then energy scarcity created energy inflation. Energy inflation stoked overall general inflation. And then raging inflation, it creates labor strife and collapses consumer confidence. And all of those things can quickly ruin a wonderful business model that is the brewing industry in the UK. Think about how destructive climate policies are these days. It can take what was competitive advantage and a traditional industry that enjoyed a competitive moat, which is brewing in the UK, and completely wreck it in a very short period of time. So obvious, so fundamental, and so damaging. But what's ironic and a bit frustrating is how the mainstream media, they just refuse to acknowledge these truths that are obvious. Instead, you know, the media points to distractions and symptoms instead of the root causes of energy and climate policies as to what's driving the tough times across the UK and its economy and its beloved industries like brewing. The sooner that we acknowledge the legitimate root cause of what's driving economic hardship more and more these days across the developed world, the better off we're going to be. Yes, it is certainly a shame with what's going on with a proud industry like brewing in the UK. It sort of reminds me of that Neil Young song, The Needle and the Damage Done. You know that one? It's a good one, warning about the dangers of drug addiction. Except in this case of what is going on with the UK economy, the song would be titled something like Climate Policy and the Damage Done. You know, it's funny to make that connection considering that Neil Young is one of those strident eco-warriors. He's one of those celebrities who loves to lecture to the rest of us as to how we should live our lives while he enjoys many of the fruits of a carbon-based world and economy on a scale that the normal person would never even be able to dream of. And I always think that celebrities like that, and particularly here, performers in the music industry, they should practice what they preach. And the one way they could do that would be that when they perform live, they should insist that every attendee arrives by foot or bicycle and not an electric bike. That's cheating. And then at the concert itself, the performer should only play an acoustic guitar with no amplification or mics. And then, of course, no lights either, because that's also carbon-based when you consider where the electricity inevitably is going to come from. So what you would end up with are concerts that are held in the daytime to people who are within walking or bike riding distance. And the size of the crowd would be set by the circumference of how far the performer's voice and acoustic guitar can extend or carry without the carbon-powered amplification. Now, that would be a crowd of about, 300 maybe, which of course would destroy the economics of touring, which then would destroy the economic model of being a musical performer or a rock act. But don't expect Neil Young or any other rock star touting their ego cred to adopt this consistent line of behavior with what they preach anytime soon. Why we insist on continuing to listen to them on these issues that they know next to nothing about, it's going to continue to confound me. Does it confound you, constant listener? Hey, enough of criticizing Neil Young, because I sort of like Neil Young. Harvest Moon, I think, was his best album. But it is amazing to me to see how the celebrities of the Neil Young variety or the media or economists, when it comes to what's ailing the UK economy, they all miss or they don't want to admit with the true root causes of all this suffering. It's obvious. And even when the elite or the expert class stumble upon the obvious, they still often fail to make the direct connection to what the finding would logically lead to when it comes to policy or policy reversal in the arena of climate and energy. And that brings us to our next connection, which falls in that arena of the expert class in energy and economics and the obvious. Researchers from Stanford University, they recently came out with the findings of a study that I was able to read about in an article. I couldn't believe how much of a big deal they were making of this, but yet how they fell short of making the final logical connection to what we should be deducing from the study. So I just had to share it with you, constant listeners, on episode 86 of The Far Middle. So first, a little bit of background on this Stanford study. There were scientists at the esteemed university. They utilized satellite imagery along with artificial intelligence to quantify the impact that electricity access has on the economic livelihood of citizens in Africa. Now, the researchers homed in on the nation of Uganda, which was a country that recently experienced an expansion of its electricity grid, so it sort of made it perfect to study. And the researchers saw that financial conditions for the areas of Uganda that gained access to electricity, well, guess what? They had roughly doubled when compared to those regions of Uganda that lacked power and access to electricity. So essentially, these PhDs and satellites and artificial intelligence tools, they use these things to figure out that in a developing world, access to reliable and affordable electricity matters. That in Africa, if you've got access to reliable and affordable electricity, you're going to be much better off and enjoy improved quality of life and better economic conditions than your fellow countrymen who do not have access to reliable and affordable electricity. Now, isn't that obvious? Do you need to be a PhD from Stanford to figure this out? Did you have to employ satellites and artificial intelligence to come to this conclusion? It makes you wonder about the level of self-awareness some of our supposedly best and brightest at our supposedly most esteemed institutions are using these days. Maybe it just goes to show that common sense isn't all that common on college campuses these days. Now, what was almost comical was how these researchers promoted the study. You see, they didn't just view this as being a master of the obvious type of a situation. They viewed it as groundbreaking stuff, for the first time ever type of findings, cutting edge research, so to speak. So just listen to some of the quotes from the Stanford researchers and their colleagues in similar roles. There was an article in Nature Communications, and researchers there referenced this technique that utilizes artificial intelligence as deep learning. That was the term that they applied to it. And the lead author from the Stanford study had a quote that said, quote, "We provide first-of-its-kind causal evidence of how electricity access impacts economic well-being at scale across an entire country in Africa," end quote. And another quote, which was a gem, from one of the professors at Stanford in this study, quote, "This insight would not have been possible just a few years ago," end quote. What are they talking about? The insight has been obvious and has been known since the start and the advent of the Industrial Revolution. Access to reliable and affordable energy, or electricity for that matter, it grows economies, it increases personal incomes, and it improves quality of life. It always has, and it always will. That's true in North America, and true in Europe, and true in Africa. It's true in the developing world, true in the developed world. It's true in rich nations, true in poor nations. You don't need satellites, you don't need artificial intelligence, you don't need deep learning, PhDs, or elite universities to figure this out. It's been proven and experienced time and time again. This is a theme that I've highlighted a number of times in my book, Precipice, The Left's Campaign to Destroy America. And it sets a connection to there being a corollary to this theme of access to reliable and affordable electricity, growing personal income, and improving quality of life. And that corollary is that if you deny or you deter or you defer access to reliable and affordable electricity, then you are necessarily suppressing growth in personal income, you're destroying quality of life, and you're denying the poor or the developing world a path to a better life. And doing so isn't just unethical, it's borderline criminal. And that's exactly what climate policies are doing these days. The policies are designed to do what? To dictate that the developing world will realize delayed access to reliable and affordable electricity by mandating that they're not to utilize things like natural gas, which is abundant, affordable, and readily available. That means under the marketing cover of Code Red for Humanity, or tackling climate change, or sustainability, that we're assigning millions, and in some instances, hundreds of millions of our fellow earthlings to miserable lives, to lower life expectancies, and to less education. It's morally wrong. It puts the abstract earth ahead of the tangible human, and it's something that should be the subject of shame for any elite or any expert or any bureaucrat or any environmentalist that's preaching the energy transition gospel. I just touched on the topic of what is morally just and what is ethical in the context of the elites or the expert class or the leader. That takes us to another connection to make. Here I want to talk about the duty and the responsibility of business leaders to speak up, to speak truth to whether it be power or whether it be the public. Recently, the Toyota Motor Corp president made international news. Why? Because he said, quote, "People involved in the auto industry are largely a silent majority. That silent majority is wondering whether EVs are really okay to have as a single option, but they think it's the trend, so they can't speak out loudly," end quote. Well, kudos, I suppose, to the president of Toyota Motor, because at least he's speaking truthfully. But he also raises yet another moral dilemma. This idea of business leaders sitting by silently and not speaking up vocally when it comes to issues that are right down the fairway of their areas of expertise or the industries that they lead. So if you were the CEO of a major automotive manufacturer and you think all of these policy prescriptions that are mandating only electric vehicles to be manufactured, if you think they're impractical and they're not in the best interest of your consumers or your workers or your shareholders, then you've got an ethical and moral duty to speak up and to advocate so that the ill-advised policy prescriptions are quickly corrected. It's pretty simple stuff when it comes to Leadership 101. Yet what we see today across businesses, especially in the arena of public corporations, is the exact opposite behavior. We see leaders who are more concerned about fitting in with the elites and the experts and the political class. We see leaders who don't want to speak up for fear of attracting unwanted attention from those in power. And we see leaders who want to further their personal brand or be popular or to participate in some instances in the type of pre-wired corporate graft that is occurring with a lot of policies in the energy and climate and transportation arenas. So if you are a CEO of an automotive maker and you think mandating only that electric vehicles be provided to consumers is a huge mistake, you've got a duty and a responsibility to speak up and to advocate. If you are the president of an energy company and you know that the laws of physics will not allow for a zero carbon grid and attempting to build one is going to wreak havoc, then you've got a duty to speak up and to advocate. And if you're the chairman of a major bank and you understand that not lending to businesses that rely on or provide carbon-based products is a road to ruin, not just for your bank, but for the entire financial system, then you've got an obligation to speak up and to advocate. Too many business leaders these days do the exact opposite. They sit by quietly, or in many instances, they join the strident voices that are looking to destroy quality of life and economies in ways that are obvious on their face to fail. Now let's jump to another connection. We've been talking about the elite and expert class and institutions such as Stanford. And we've been talking about the moral duty and ethical obligation for leaders of institutions to speak up when they see an obvious policy or model that is broken or ill-advised or won't work. And we've been talking about how obvious conclusions staring us in the face can be treated almost as if they are eureka moments by the expert class if they reside in a bit of a cocoon where the common person looks at it and says, of course, that's obvious. Now, all of these themes, they tie to our next connection. College tuition continues to skyrocket, and students continue to not enjoy a rate of return on their investment of time and money. In universities, they show no interest or urgency in reforming what is a broken business model. Instead, academia collaborates with the federal government to subsidize the failed business model, making reform less likely and making the business model more broken, if that's even possible. And one of the most obvious symptoms of how broken the higher education model is these days can be found in numbers. Specifically, the numbers of students and faculty and administrators at higher education institutions. So Stanford will be used as an example once again in episode 86, because Stanford is viewed as a great institution. Yet consider the math of Stanford stakeholders. Stanford has just under 17,000 students and just under 2,300 faculty. Guess how many administrative staff Stanford employs? Well, the answer might shock you. Nearly 16,000 administrative staff at Stanford. That's almost a bureaucrat for every student. And that's almost 7 bureaucrats for every faculty member. And we wonder why tuition is out of control. We wonder why students are not receiving a rate of return on their investment. And we wonder why academia sees a comrade in arms when it looks to government. Swollen administrative staffing roles at universities are one of the leading contributors to how the academic business model is fundamentally broken. And until leaders of these institutions are willing to take on and address this problem of the administrative state within our universities, the business model of higher education will never be fixed or returned to what it once was. Our time is coming to an end for episode 86 of The Far Middle. I really enjoyed this one, thought we got into some deep topics. And I did mention at the start of our episode that I was going to conclude with a birthday dedication. This episode is first going to air on January 11th. That is the birthday of one of the greatest Americans, one of the most influential of the founding fathers, that being the great Alexander Hamilton. He is one of my top 3 favorite founding fathers, perhaps my favorite overall. That's sort of ironic, I suppose, considering that my political and philosophical views lean toward the libertarian, whereas Hamilton, you know, he was a strong voice and proponent of a strong federal government. But the guy was amazing. Our nation would not have ascended to what it is without him. Heck, our nation would not have even been born without him. So why do I love Alexander Hamilton, despite my libertarian bent? Well, there's a couple of reasons. And, you know, the first one, Hamilton, he was the ultimate self-made person. You know, he wasn't of the landed gentry or elite class. He didn't have some sort of royal lineage. No, Hamilton, he had a chip on his shoulder. And you would too if you had his background. He was born on Nevis, the Caribbean island, and he was sent to college in the colonies only after he wrote an article in the local paper about a hurricane. And the locals who read it, they were so impressed with his skills at writing that they put up a collection to send him off to college. And by the way, Princeton rejected Alexander Hamilton as a potential student. He ended up going to what became Columbia University. Now, the second thing I love about Hamilton, he was extremely brave and a war hero. He played a pivotal role in the Battle of Yorktown, and he was the aide-de-camp of General Washington during the Revolutionary War. I don't know if you've ever been or if you ever have a chance to visit the Yorktown battlefield just outside of Williamsburg, Virginia. But if you do, you can walk right up to one of the British redoubts that Hamilton led the charge of that proved to be a crucial moment in the battle and thus a crucial moment in the war. Third thing that I love about Hamilton, he was one of the co-authors of the Federalist Papers, which of course served as a basis for drafting what became our Constitution. One of his co-authors was another one of my favorites, James Madison. And what's interesting about the Federalist Papers is that it wasn't made public that Hamilton was a co-author until after he died. but he did end up writing over half of the Federalist Papers. Another thing to love about Hamilton, he was the first Treasury Secretary of the history of the United States, appointed, of course, by our first president, President Washington, and as Treasury Secretary, he helped stave off bankruptcy of the country, and he basically birthed our nation's banking system. And how about this item to love about Hamilton? He formed the first political party in our nation, which was the Federalist Party, that inevitably had the consequence of creating an opposition party, which became the Democratic Republicans, and that was headed by Thomas Jefferson, among others. So I guess Hamilton got partisan politics off and running in our nation's history. And the last thing to love about Hamilton, he was the inspiration for an awesome Broadway musical. And I'm going to close episode 86 with a quote from the musical Hamilton. "My name is Alexander Hamilton. There are a million things I haven't done. Just you wait." Well, this is the far middle. There are a million topics we haven't covered yet. Just you wait till next week for episode 87. Bye now.